as it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. As we've been talking about this opt-out movement coming to Philadelphia, and, you know, I've been on this for several years now. And you go back to, as I said earlier in the program, you know, my oldest daughter, you know, play teaching with the younger two, saying, if we don't pass the test, they're going to take money and we're going to be out of the school. There'll be nothing, everything closed, dire doom, gloom, all of that. And I got to tell you, scary stuff to me, because that's not what education should be. So out of that sprung this United Opt Out movement. And there's a big conference coming up in Philadelphia this February. And I thought it'd be a great opportunity to reach out to one of the folks coordinating it here in Pennsylvania for the United Opt Out folks. Allison McDowell is the Pennsylvania coordinator for United Opt Out. She's also a parent of a student there in the Philadelphia area. Allison, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, well, thanks so much for covering this important topic and encouraging people to come out to the conference. It's great.
So I guess the first part of it, why Philadelphia?
So Philadelphia is one of the epicenters of education reform, and obviously high-stakes standardized testing is a key element that they use in school closures and turnarounds. We've been at, you know, going through this for the past over a decade of not having local control of our schools and continued budget crises and austerity, when there always seems to be money for technology and testing, but not facilities and teachers and reducing classroom size. So with every couple of months, something new comes up and we're fighting new battles. In fact, we just had three schools that were being sought to take over, being taken over by charter operators here. And there's legislation being under consideration in the state legislature that would change the school code that would target Philadelphia specifically, so that every year up to five of the lowest performing schools, quote unquote, based largely on test scores, could be handed over to charter operators. So, you know, we're right in the crosshairs and have been for some time. Fortunately, like at this point, there's been a lot more grassroots organization to fight back against the privatization forces.
Right.
We have a group of parents called Opt Out Philly, and we've been driving Opt Out. We had a lot of success the past spring testing season, whereas before, I think in our district, there were maybe 20 or 30 parents, students opted out. The number surged up to over 600.
Wow.
So percentage-wise, it was really, you know, quite a big leap, and we were able to sort of create a pretty smooth process with filling out form letters and to really empower parents to make that decision and be informed that they had those rights. So we have a network that we're building on, and we are working in collaboration with the Caucus of Working Educators, which is a caucus within the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers whose focus is social justice unionism and really working with parents and communities to get the schools our kids deserve, and that's schools that are not being driven by data and testing. And so they're in the process right now of doing a lot of organizing on the ground in building the caucus itself, and I'm really excited for the spring to continue collaborating with them on, you know, connecting parents with the information they need to opt their children out of the test.
Right. I mean, you know, and before we get to the big conference coming up here at the end of February, you know, to me, this opt-out movement is that first step towards empowering parents to grab back some control, because, you know, I think you're right. You've hit it on the head. You've got, especially in places like Philadelphia, where this corporate education reform is being imposed upon them without any real voice. And this is a small way of saying, you know, we're going to fight back, isn't it?
Correct. And it's very straightforward. And I am all for continuing to sort of fight politically and build power and show up and have rallies. But, you know, not everyone can expend the effort to continue to do that. So opting out is a very clear, straightforward process where you, in fact, this year in Philadelphia, what we're organizing around is not strictly the religious opt-out, which is the state law in Pennsylvania, but is outright refusal. And what this is sort of a nuanced argument, and it may not necessarily, not every district may be as fully receptive, but on the front of the PSSA and Keystone testing booklets, there's a bubble called other. So there's one for parental, like, opt-out, and there's one for other, and the other is for refusal. So for a lot of parents who, in Pennsylvania, the opt-out process that's part of the Pennsylvania code is that you're objecting on religious grounds, so you have to review the test and just simply state that. they can't ask you any particulars, but that's how the process runs, is that you review the test and then you make this statement that on religious grounds you're opting your child out. For many people, that's very complicated. They may not be in a position of going in to do the review. They may feel intimidated by school administration to do the review. Refusal is simply just saying, code my child as other. It's also a no score, not a zero. Same result as the opt-out. You don't have to do the review. You don't have to bring your religion into it. And for many of our families, because we had two schools that had over 150 families opting out, and you can imagine how challenging that would be to a school to, like,
certainly,
have that many parents coming in and out of the office to review the test. It's a little logistically challenging.
Yeah, it is. And I remember, you know, going through this process numerous times, and, you know, it is an arduous process. You've got to sign almost a blood oath that you'll never talk about what you see on the test, which is kind of creepy to me and kind of scary that you have to sign this that, you know, cannot talk about test or we're going to come for you.
Yeah. And so this year, we were fortunate in that our district last spring, they said any parent who had written documentation that they did not want the child to take the test, they did the review, they coded it as opt-out. If they did not make it in to do the review, they coded it as other, which is the refusal code. And that's great. So now we're just doing refusal at this point. I mean, people are still welcome to do opt-out, but I think it's a much clearer process just to go for refusal. People, you have the parent's signature on a fill-in-the-blank form. And if you're interested, I could send you a copy if there's a place to stick it on your website or somewhere.
Most certainly.
And do that. I mean, what we're seeing is the next challenge is that I think there's going to be ultimately a movement away from the end of the year test because of the direction they're taking education policy next.
Right.
And we're seeing a real big growth in increasing numbers of mid-year benchmark testing and CDT testing and AIMS web testing so that we're losing more and more and more time, instructional time, to data gathering. And that's the direction they'll say, we won't have an end-of-the-year test eventually, that we'll just use your data all the time. But increasingly, kids will be spending more and more and more time accessing their education through a device.
Yeah, I think that's important to mention, Allison, because, you know, I just had this conversation the other day with a friend who's a couple years younger than I am, and he was saying that, you know, when did all of this, because you named off like 10 different names of tests, mm-hmm, that when I was a kid, it was just the teacher gave a test. It didn't have this, that, or the other thing. It wasn't a corporate test. It was something that the teacher, you know, that's what printed off and copied off and gave you. We seem to now have all of these corporate tests, and it may not even be the big one at the end of the year. It seems to be all of these for specifically the purpose of, as you've said, gathering that data and centralizing it.
Yeah. I mean, and it's incredible. Every year they're adding new ones. So this past October, they gave all of, you've heard of the PSAT test. So you
right.
have the SAT scores for college, you know, test. And then it used to be that if you were a junior, you took the practice, PSAT. And some kids, if you're a really awesome test taker, you might be able to access a scholarship opportunity or qualify. Well, now the College Board that runs those tests has also created a whole suite of additional assessments. So instead of maybe taking it in 10th grade to practice it for the 11th grade to practice for the SAT, now they actually want to test 8th and 9th graders. So they've created a whole new PSAT test directly to 8th and 9th grade to get them on the track to do online practice drills to improve their test scores. And we're talking, like, we're pushing this down into middle school now. And in Philadelphia, they used our Title I funding, which is funding for students living in poverty, to pay for students, ninth grade students, to take these tests. Well, there's no benefit to a ninth grade student. You can't qualify for a scholarship. There's nothing to it but data mining. And the tests also have a very extensive demographic survey up front that asks things like parents' college attainment and, you know, religion and, you know, all sorts of very probing questions that no one tells parents, this is an optional test, you don't have to take this test. In some cases, we had schools having kids take the test and then charging parents retroactively for it. And again, we're a high-poverty district.
Wow.
So there's incredible amounts of data that's being combined, just not only in the state test and in the interim test, but even within outside vendors like the College Board.
Is anyone asking what happens with all of this data? I mean, you know, where does it go? Who has it? Especially when you start talking about, you know, the demographic surveys of our kids. You know, any idea where that goes?
So there's a federal longitudinal database. So the state collects all of this information on students. And there's a program by which they want to continue to expand the data that is collected. And they're pulling in there's a grants-funded program from the U.S. Department of Education for states to improve their data collection. And in fact, a lot of the data collection is going to cross over between state departments of education, along with departments of labor and departments of higher education and departments of health and human services. So they really want to consolidate all of that data profile on your child across agencies.
Wow.
Which is, and then ultimately one of the steps, like in improving the data collection, was like adding the College Board data into that. So local districts collect this data, they send it to the state aggregates the data, they send it to a federal database. Theoretically, any of your child's data can be shared for quote unquote research purposes under FERPA. So, and without your knowledge or consent. And it's very much a stretch what they consider research, you know, that's a pretty wide net that can be justified as research.
Yeah.
So the thing is, they want the data from preschool to age 20 plus, you know, and they'll use it to say, well, we want to know if we do interventions when your child is in second grade in reading, do they graduate college and go on to be gainfully employed? But essentially, we're creating a tracking system for kids throughout their life, which is, and with the new Every Student Succeeds Act, the federal legislation that's replacing No Child Left Behind, they've also added in that they want additional tracking of non-cognitive skills.
Wow.
So things like your grit and your resilience and, you know, a lot of other things that would be tracked into that as well. And there's a lot of research that's being done around, you know, linking, being able to, like, monitor heart rates and, like, biometric readings of kids, like, as they interact with their online education. And it's a little brave new world, but the infrastructure is all very much there. So,
not a little brave new world.
I would just encourage parents to be very mindful about the data that's being collected. I actually just recently filed a right to know request for my child of what's in the state database system. And I got that back. So I could provide a link to that as well for the request letter of how you go about finding out what data is.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Because, I'm sitting here thinking back to when my oldest daughter was born. We had stored the cord blood, you know, one of the first people to do it, the first person at the hospital to do that. So I guess that triggered off, a message or a beacon to all of the of these other groups. And then someone approached me and asked if we wanted to chip our daughter. Because they were doing that V-chip thing just starting at the time. And, of course, not. But they wanted to put a little kernel of in her arm with an RFID chip to track her. They don't need to do that. They're just doing it through her school.
Yeah. Well, and the other piece, too, so now in our school district, they have new school district student email accounts that are run through Google. So they have a phyllisd.org extension, but they're Google accounts, Google Apps for Education. The address for all of the children, their email address, is their student ID number. So my daughter's in high school. They use that Google email. We don't really have resources to have full-on independent laptop carts or, you know, cloud storage, so we have inexpensive Chromebooks. And to access a Chromebook, you need to log in with an email account.
Wow.
So pretty much once you've logged into your school-issued Chromebook with your student ID number, every click is tracked. Every email message that goes out can be data mined. Every file that's uploaded to your Google Drive, that your every PowerPoint you create, and people might say, oh, well, that's not a problem if you're not doing anything bad with it. But my question is, like, in high school, part of what we want is for people to be able to grapple with difficult conversations and talk about issues. And, you know, we're in a world that we need to have these kinds of conversations. And, you know, increasingly people are saying, oh, here's a question, like, go online and collaboratively work up a document, you know, about things. Well, that's like a permanent record. It never goes away. And if they could theoretically data mine all of those Google Docs, you know, and it would sound very nice. They might say something like, oh, you know, we're very concerned about, you know, suicide rates in middle school girls that fit this profile.
Right.
Let's go data mine all these email accounts. And, you know, it's a real concern.
So, it's
getting a little bit off the opt-out track. But ultimately, I think where we're going is the student data privacy is going to be the next frontier of opt-out.
Yeah, so let's get to this because, you know, I want to make sure folks have the opportunity to sign up to maybe come out to the United Opt-Out Conference in Philadelphia. And I understand it's going to start on Friday, February 26th?
Yes. So there's a Friday late afternoon keynote speech with, I believe, Dr. Stephen Krashen, and then sort of a reception afterwards gathering. And then the core of the conference, it'll be all day on Saturday and then Sunday morning until about 1 o'clock. And it's a combination of keynote speakers, panel discussions, and breakout groups. So we have some really inspiring speakers coming up, and the theme is sort of revolutionary, because I feel like we're to a point that moving forward, small measures are not going to get us where we need to go.
No, I mean, just listening
so the
to
theme
what...
is somewhat like empowering this to make major change. And I first attended a United Opt-Out conference 2 years ago after I saw Dan Hornberger's, who's a Pennsylvania teacher. He created a documentary called Standardized about testing. And I said, wow, this bowls me over as a parent, and I want to find whoever's working on this locally because I think this is really important. And I realized Philadelphia was in such chaos over a lot of other issues. Testing wasn't the main thing. There was no one really organizing around testing. So I went to the United Opt-Out Conference in Denver, which was about a month later, and seeing the scope of the people in the room from across the country, it just hit home the scale of the battle that we were in, that this wasn't just an urban problem, like an urban privatization issue that we were facing in Philadelphia. There were people from Massachusetts, from New Mexico, from Minnesota. There were people from across the country in many different geographic areas who were all experiencing the same thing. And it just makes you really want to be galvanized to fix it because you realize the scale of the problem and that really I think our democracy is sort of hanging in the balance of how this is going to turn out.
Yeah, when the corporations get their hands on it, nothing good, in my view, comes of it. Is there a cost associated with the conference?
Yes. So the one thing about United Opt-Out is it's completely self-funded. So we have no corporate sponsors. We take no foundation money. It's all being run out of the people who are involved in their own pockets. So it's the conference is at International House, and there are costs associated with that space, as well as, you know, some various basic costs. So it's
sure.
A $90 fee for the 3-day conference.
That's not unreasonable.
So that's sort of where we are with that. There's information if you go online, you just Google United Opt Out. It's the main thing that will come up, and I'm sure Morna can have more details on that, but there's a link to register. I think there's about space for 150 people. And, you know, what's really great about this conference is that it brings together incredibly passionate people from across the country. And what I've realized over the course of being in the scene for a couple of years is that in my sense that United Opt-Out, it stands very closely with its principles and it does not compromise.
Oh, that's a good thing.
And I admire them greatly as an organization.
Yeah, it's a group.
Of all the conferences, this is the one that I most look forward to, and I'm very glad to have them in my backyard because we need their help.
I'm right there with you. It's a group we've had on the program many times. In fact, we're working on trying to get down there to talk to people and interview folks during the big conference because I think it's that important. But Allison, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great talking with you, and we need more parents like you, passionate advocates for our kids, and I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you, Rick.
Great talking with you, Allison McDonald. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. The Rick Smith Show.